Well, good morning, everybody. You didn't know it, but we're in Las Vegas this morning. And I wonder if you ever feel like sort of how your life goes is wrapped up in the roll of a dice. It's kind of like sometimes you're lucky, sometimes you're not. You know, maybe sometimes you roll lucky seven. Look at that. A seven. How about that? You know, so sometimes things just go awesome for you. Sometimes things don't go quite so good. And you wonder about that. Some people say that how things go for us and the things that happen to us are really kind of just a coincidence. Like you're in the right place at the right time and you're lucky. Others say it's more than that. That there's someone behind it all, someone who is sort of taking all the little pieces of life and using them to accomplish a greater purpose according to a greater plan. And I know that many of us here believe that. And yet we also wonder sometimes, how do our choices play into that? I mean, if it's all part of a larger plan and if all things happen because this higher power is controlling all the events of our lives, then what part do our choices play in the outcome of all of it? Well, today we're looking at chapter 20 of the story. So hopefully you guys have one of these things. And we've come to a place in the story, if you'll remember, where God's people have been taken into exile into Babylon. While they were there, Babylon is overtaken by another world power called Persia. And the Persians had a different way of handling their subjects than the Babylonians did. King Cyrus of Persia actually allowed the Jews to return to Palestine. And many of them chose to do that. As a matter of fact, about 50,000 Jews chose to return to Palestine. But that was just a fraction of the Jews that were in Persia. And so most of them actually chose to stay in Persia. For many of them, as you might imagine, that's all they ever knew. And this is where chapter 20 comes in. Chapter 20 of the story covers what we know of as the story of Esther. And if you have a Bible, you might want to turn there. We're going to be looking at the whole story of Esther this morning. The story of Esther tells us about what life was like for those people who stayed in Persia. And it tells us that God did not abandon his people who stayed back in Persia. It's like they didn't get written out of God's story. God continued to be with them in Persia. And it's very interesting because the story of Esther, the book of Esther, is one of only two books in the entire Bible where the name of God is not even mentioned. The other one, by the way, is Song of Songs. But God is not even mentioned. And I'm sure that there were many times when those people in Persia felt like God was absent completely. And yet what we're going to see is that God is all over this wonderful story. So let me just give you a little bit of an introduction by letting you know that there are four main characters in this story. I want to introduce you to them before we get rolling here, okay? So, each of them, I'm going to assign a playing card since we have a little Las Vegas theme going on today, okay? First of all, there's a king, all right? The king's name is Xerxes. He's the king of Persia. Xerxes is the most powerful man on the face of the earth. Second, there's a queen. And actually in this story, of course, the queen is Xerxes' wife. And there are actually two women who are going to fill this role as the story plays out. The first queen is Vashti. Things don't go too well for Vashti. And she is replaced by another queen, the Queen of Hearts, a young Jewish woman named Esther. Third, there's a joker. Not in the sense of being funny, but in the sense of being an antagonist, a foil, if you will, a bad guy. His name is Haman. Haman rose to power under the rule of Xerxes. And as we'll see, Haman hated the Jews with a vengeance. Finally, there's an ace. And his name is Mordecai. Mordecai is Esther's older cousin, kind of like Uncle Mordecai, if you will. He raised her. Mordecai is an ordinary Jew. Many believe he had a governmental job in Persia because he's always found at the king's gate. But he will become an ace in the hole for the Jewish people. The story begins in Xerxes' palace in the capital city of Susa. In the third year of his reign, Xerxes throws a party. Now, this isn't just any old party. This is a party that would last 180 days. That's 6 months. And the idea in this party is to invite people from all over his kingdom, important people, to come in to Susa and admire his wealth and admire his power. And part of that is he is trying to plan a military campaign against Greece. And after 180 days is up, it's capped off with a 7-day banquet. And the king says at that banquet, you can drink all you want. It is an open bar. This king, just so you know, loves to party. And we'll see that as the story plays out. Then Xerxes has an idea, and we see it in chapter 1, verse 10. On the 7th day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, he commanded the 7 eunuchs who served him to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. You should know that many believe Xerxes actually wanted his wife, Queen Vashti, to come in wearing only her crown. And so you can imagine why her response makes sense. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. She refuses to be paraded before a bunch of drunken men like a piece of meat. Now, of course, when you refuse the king, that is humiliating and embarrassing to the king. And so he's got to figure out what to do here. And so he consults his advisors. Guys, what do I do about this? And one of them said, listen, king, we have a problem here. We cannot have a queen who disrespects her husband. I mean, if this gets out, King Xerxes, all the women in the kingdom will think they can go around disrespecting their husbands. You got to do something, king, and you got to do it fast. So the king does something. He banishes Queen Vashti from his presence forever. She is in the doghouse, if you will. And he sends a reminder, I love this, out to each member of his kingdom. He sends like this reminder to everybody in his kingdom, and it says, every man should be ruler over his own household. I don't want to hear any amens there, okay? 4 years go by. Things don't go so well in Xerxes' campaign against Greece. He begins to feel kind of depressed, kind of lonely. I mean, he has a harem, but again, you know, like no companion, no wife. And so his advisors come up with this idea. Hey, king, how about we have a beauty contest? We'll get all the beautiful women from your kingdom together in one place. We'll give them all the spa and beauty treatments they want or need. We'll even let them spend a night with you, king. And then you get to pick who's going to be your new queen. I can imagine Xerxes says, okie dokie. I'm sure they all volunteered to be judges, too. This is where Esther comes in, chapter 2, verse 7. Now there was in the city of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. So this young Jewish girl named Esther becomes part of this beauty contest, and she begins early on to win the favor of many of the officials who were running this contest, and she gets special treatment. She gets special beauty treatments. She gets the best cosmetics, the best perfume, and we're told that this goes on for an entire year. Some of you guys think your wife takes a long time to get ready. Well, a whole year here. And by the way, this entire time, Esther tells no one in the palace that she is Jewish. Nobody knows. It's a big secret. Mordecai told her, don't tell anyone you're Jewish. Don't tell anyone about your connection to me. So nobody knows. Well, as you might have imagined, Xerxes has completely fallen in love with Esther. After 12 months, he chooses Esther to be his new queen. He's so excited. He does what you'd expect him to do. He throws another party. Again, this guy likes to party. And he makes the day that she becomes queen a national holiday in all of Persia. At the end of chapter 2, the scene shifts rather dramatically. And we read about something that seems kind of insignificant, but as the story plays out, it will be very important. Mordecai, remember Uncle Mordecai? He hears about two of the king's officers who are actually plotting to assassinate the king. Mordecai hears about this. He sends a message to Esther. She reports it to the king. An investigation takes place. It's found to be true. The two conspirators are impaled on a pole, and the whole incident, including Mordecai's role, is recorded in the annals of the king. Sometimes after this, we're told that Xerxes needed some help administrating his kingdom, and so he hires a man named Haman, and he makes Haman his second in command. Haman, you should know, is absolutely 100% addicted to power. You know, sometimes when you elevate a person to a high level of authority, you really see what they're all about. And in the case of Haman, Haman is all about himself. Haman is in love with himself. He's in love with power. As a matter of fact, Haman actually required, when he walked around, that anybody who saw him had to bow down before him. I mean, that's what an ego trip Haman was on. Something else about Haman you should know. He is a racist. He's part of an ethnic group that had hated the Jews. He's part of a group called the Amalekites, and they had held a grudge against the Jews going way back to the time of Moses. So you can understand why Haman is so upset when he meets Mordecai. Because as a Jew, Mordecai refuses to bow down and show respect in that way to Haman. And this infuriates Haman. We read in chapter 3, verse 6, yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he, that is Haman, scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the whole kingdom of Xerxes. So Haman, if you will, is a Hitler. He is a racist bent on genocide. So Haman goes straight to Xerxes. He tells him about this religious group within his kingdom who refuse to bow to the king's authority. He says, listen, king, they're not like us. They're not on board with your policies, king. And people are starting to wonder, you know, who's really in charge here? Haman even offers him a boatload of money And he asks the king to establish a decree in which a day would be set to destroy the Jews. And the king agrees. And you know what they did? They rolled dice in order to figure out exactly what day it would be that the Jews would be annihilated. They rolled dice. They were called poor. They rolled the poor. They cast the lots to figure out the exact day. And a day was chosen 11 months down the road. It says dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. So imagine being a Jewish person, maybe a Jewish father or mother, and you receive and hear of this edict during this time. Imagine the fear. Imagine the questions this would raise in your mind about God. God, where are you? God, have you abandoned us? God, what about your promises? God, you said you would never leave us nor forsake us. God, where are you? And we know that these are all questions that we ask from time to time. By the way, right after that terrible edict is sent out, it says this: the king and Haman sat down to drink. I mean, isn't that interesting? Here, this order of execution has been sent out, and the very next thing these two guys do is walk out to the pool and start sipping wine coolers. That's how calloused, that's how evil these guys are. And of course, when Mordecai finds out about this edict to kill his people 11 months down the road, he is wrecked. He puts on sackcloth and ashes, and he begins to walk around the city of Susa, weeping and wailing loudly. Jews from all over the kingdom begin to do the same thing. And Queen Esther hears about all this, and she sends someone to Mordecai to see what in the world's going on. She didn't know about the edict. Mordecai gives this courier a copy of the edict to show Esther. And he asks Esther to go into the king's presence and plead with him on behalf of her people. But she sends back to Mordecai. She says, listen, Mordecai, it doesn't work that way. If the king doesn't hold out his golden scepter, you don't dare go into his presence, king. I mean, you could get killed that way. He could kill me for doing that. And by the way, Mordecai, things have been a little bit chilly between the king and I lately. I haven't seen him for an entire month. She sends that back to Mordecai. Mordecai still won't back down. Mordecai scratches out another message, sends it back to Esther. And I want you to listen to what he says in chapter 4, verse 13. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. It's interesting, he never mentions God's name. And yet, again, God is all over this. He's saying, listen, Esther, God will look out for his people. God will keep his promises to us. But have you considered, Esther, that it's no mistake that you are in the position of influence that you are in? Maybe this isn't all just a roll of the dice, Esther. Maybe God has arranged to put you in that place so you could be an instrument of deliverance for your people. And I think this is what we would all call a defining moment, isn't it? Have you ever had a defining moment in your life? A moment in your life where who you really are must come out. Where your primary identity as either a follower of Christ or something else will be revealed. I think we all have defining moments. This was a defining moment for Esther. Esther reads this and she takes it to heart. She also realizes that she is about to do something that unless God steps in, she will lose her life. She writes back to Mordecai. Listen to what she says. Go, gather all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I'll go to the king, even though it's against the law. And then I love these words. And if I perish, I perish. Esther is not just beautiful on the outside. Esther is courageous and beautiful on the inside. Again, she never mentions God. But she's leaning very hard on God here, isn't she? She believes in the power of prayer and fasting. And so she calls for prayer and fasting for 3 full days. And after 3 days, Esther does what no one else dares to do. She stands in the inner court of the palace, right in front of the king's room where he's seated on his throne, and she waits. And when he sees her, it says he was pleased with her and held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of his scepter. And he asks her, what do you want? And he actually offers her in that very moment, you can have up to half my kingdom. Honestly, I think he had had a few. But instead of coming out with a request, she invites he and Haman to a banquet. The king says, I love parties, of course. So he grabs Haman, off they go. At the party, we're told that they're enjoying some good wine. And he asks Esther again, Esther, what is it you want? I'll give you up to half my kingdom. And for some reason, Esther still doesn't feel like the time is right. And so she says, King, I want you to come to another banquet tomorrow night and be sure to bring Haman with you. And I'll tell you what I want tomorrow night. Now remember, Haman's there. Haman's thinking, man, this is awesome. Little dinner, me, the king, the queen. Yeah. He's riding high. How can life get any better than this? But then, as he's walking out of the king, or strutting out of the king's palace, guess who he sees? It's that fly buzzing around his picnic table, Mordecai, who again refuses to bow down to him. Haman is incensed. He wants to off Mordecai right there, but he holds off. He goes home to his family. The first thing he says is, oh, guess where I'm going tomorrow night? The king and the queen are having just me over for a little din-din. And by the way, you know that Jew Mordecai? He still doesn't get it. I saw him on the way home and he still disrespects me. So his wife says, have a pole set up, reaching to a height of 50 cubits. And by the way, I've heard about wives that are defensive of their husbands when their husbands get hurt, but this takes the cake, okay? And ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself. Haman's like, love that idea. Then the scene shifts back to the king. That night, for some reason, the king can't sleep. I mean, he can't get to sleep. And so, you know how you do when you can't sleep and sometimes you just give up trying and you say, okay, I'm going to read something.
So he decides to read something. So he picks up a book that chronicles the events of his reign. The perfect sleeping pill. But as he's reading, he comes across a story about something that happened a few years back. About a Jew named Mordecai who had uncovered an assassination plot and actually had saved the king's life in the process. And so he calls one of his assistants and he says, "Hey, did you know about this guy Mordecai? Did we ever do anything for this guy? I've never even heard of this guy." And his servant says, "No, we did nothing." Now, right at that moment, it's interesting. It just so happened that the king overheard somewhere, someone in his outer court. Guess who it was? It was Haman. Haman had gotten up early that morning to come and ask the king for permission to impale Mordecai on that pole he had set up in his backyard. The king invites Haman into his throne room, and before Haman can say a single word, the king asks Haman, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honor?" Haman's thinking, "This is awesome. I mean, I get to go to a banquet tonight with the king and the queen. I get to kill Mordecai on a pole. And now the king wants to honor me." And so I think he kind of put on his most humble face, spoke in the most humble tones he could possibly speak in. And he says, "Oh, I have an idea, king. Have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden. Let them robe that man the king delights to honor and lead him on a horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, 'This is what is done for the man the king delights to honor.' I think that would be a wonderful thing to do for that man, King Xerxes." The king says, "Go at once, get the robe and the horse, and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai, the Jew, who sits at the king's gate." I wish I could have seen the look on Haman's face. I kind of think there's a twitch that... But what could he do? And he does exactly what the king says. He spends the whole day parading Mordecai around with the king's robe on the king's horse, announcing to everyone, "This is what the king does for the man he delights to honor." But remember, that night, there's still the banquet that Esther has invited him to, so at least he has that to look forward to. So he rushes home, changes his clothes, heads over to the palace, and there they are, the three of them, the queen, the king, Haman. And the king says to Esther, "Okay, now, please tell me what I can do for you. Again, up to half your kingdom, or my kingdom." Finally, Esther makes the big ask. Chapter 7, verse 3. "If I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be," and look at, she uses the exact same wording from the edict, "destroyed, killed, and annihilated." And this upsets Xerxes. He asks her, "Well, who is he? Who has sold your people to be killed? Where is he? Where's the man who has dared to do such a thing?" And I can just imagine Esther pointing her finger right at Haman and saying, "An adversary and an enemy, this vile Haman." I love what it says next. You know what it says next? Listen to this. It says, "The king got up in a rage, left his wine." I mean, I just love how the Bible is written. Why would he say that? Because it was significant. He never leaves his wine. He left his wine and went out into the palace garden. I mean, he's like, he's got to figure out, what am I going to do about this? We got a problem here. And so he needs to kind of walk it off a little bit. Meanwhile, Haman, of course, is left there with Esther, terrified. And he begins to beg Esther for his life. And just after a few minutes, the king decides to re-enter the room. And wouldn't you know it, Haman trips, probably over a Persian rug. Haman trips, falls on Esther, right as the king is walking in. And the king sees Haman way too close to his wife. And I'm sure the king said something like, "So now you're coming on to my wife?" And that's all it takes for the king to order Haman's execution. It says they covered Haman's face. It's like, "Hey, dude, it's curtains for you. Lights out." One of the servants even says to the king, King, I just went by Haman's house. And I noticed he's got a pole 50 cubits high set up in his backyard. It was for Mordecai, you know, the guy that saved your life." Gee, it'd be a shame to have that go to waste, king. And so the king says, "Impale him on it." So they impaled Haman on the pole that he'd set up for Mordecai. Can you believe this story? Unbelievable, but true. Let me summarize what happens from there. Finally, Esther reveals to the king that Mordecai is her Jewish cousin. She brings Mordecai in to meet the king, and they together beg him to do something about this edict to kill the Jews 11 months later. Back then, it was absolutely impossible for the king, like Xerxes, to reverse an edict that he had sent out. I mean, it is what it is. You don't change your mind back then. But you could send another edict out. And so basically what he ended up doing is he sent another edict out that said the Jews on that day had the right to gather and protect themselves using any means possible. And that new edict is sent throughout the kingdom. And the result, it says, was joy and gladness among the Jews. And sure enough, when that day came, 11 months later, not a single Jew perishes. Meanwhile, Mordecai is given the entire state, a state of Haman. And he is made second in command to Xerxes. One more thing that's important. The Jews decided at that point to make those days, there were 2 days, I believe it was the 14th and 15th day in the month of Adar, close to Passover, by the way, they decided to make those days a feast day, a national holiday, if you will. It's one of their feasts. It's today, in the Jewish faith, it's one of their minor feasts, like Hanukkah is a minor feast for them, but they celebrate this, and they call it, you know what they call it? The Feast of Purim. The Feast of Purim. The Feast of the Dice. That's what they call it. Because it was on that day that Haman rolled the dice and picked a day to annihilate the Jews. But it was on that day that God reversed that edict. And all the Jews were saved. All the Jews were saved. It was a day of joy. Even today, sort of secular Jews. I mean, it's the most raucous of all their holidays, man. It's a day of feasting, a day of joy, and they just have a blast on that day. What a story. What does this mean for us today? A few things have come to mind. One of the things is, man, God writes incredible stories, right? But here's the deal. One thing I think this story does is it reminds us of the reality of evil in our world. It's easy to kind of just pass over that because things turn out so nicely in this story. But I don't think we can. Powerful, prideful, calloused, and drunken men like Xerxes and Haman are still with us today. I think we all know that. And we know that all of our stories do not end up quite as nicely as this one does, do they? Last month, I was in Cambodia with Neil Benson. And we had a free day in Phnom Penh before the conference started that we were a part of, and we visited two places. One of them I had been to before, but the other one I had not. Unforgettable places. The first one was a high school that was turned into a torture chamber and a prison under the communist regime and leadership of Pol Pot of the Khmer Rouge. And so anyone who was educated in the city of Phnom Penh, anyone who was educated was thought to be a threat. And so, for example, if you wore eyeglasses or if you had hands that were not calloused and were soft, then you were considered to be an educated person. And so you were taken to that former high school. As a matter of fact, Paul Newt, our mission partner, who I went with to Cambodia, attended high school there. That's where he went to high school. And so this became a prison and a torture chamber where they tried to get Cambodian people to confess crimes that they had not committed. And then you were brought to another location, and this is where we get our common name, the killing fields, and we were taken out there. This is where people were slaughtered and thrown into mass graves, and it was horrific. And there are bone fragments still left on the ground. They've preserved this, and there are still bone fragments scattered across the ground from the victims. The worst part is right in the middle of the killing fields, there is a tree with a sign that says, "Killing tree against which executioners beat children." And both Neil and I just almost lost it. Under the Khmer Rouge, somewhere around 2 to 3 million people were killed. And that's just an example of the reality of evil. And I think this story reminds us that we live in a world like that. We also learn, though, in this story that God somehow is still sovereign over all the events of this world and over all the events of our lives. This is a story about the mysterious providence, sovereignty, whatever you want to call it, of God. God is able to order events and circumstances in such a way that we are delivered from evil. I love what Proverbs chapter 16, verse 33 says. It says, "The lot is cast into the lap." In other words, the dice are thrown, but its every decision is from the Lord. The Lord's in charge of the roll of the dice. And so here we have a book in which God's name is not even mentioned. And it looks as if God's people have been abandoned and they will be wiped out. But God has made promises to them. God has said, "I will never leave you nor forsake you." God has said the Messiah, one who, like Esther, will act courageously to deliver his people, will come from them. God has made those promises. And God is still with his people wherever we are. Haman rolled the dice, but God determined the course of what would happen to his people. Esther is chosen from all the women in the kingdom to be the new queen. Coincidence? Mordecai overhears a plot to assassinate the king. Coincidence? Xerxes can't sleep. Little bit of insomnia, and he just happens to pick up a book that tells about something a guy named Mordecai did years earlier. Coincidence? Someone said coincidences are those incidences where God is working a miracle anonymously. I love that. You know, we talk about the upper story and the lower story as we go through the story of God in this book. We talk about the upper story and the lower story. The lower story of Esther, you might say it's about an ace who challenged a queen to confront a king about a joker. That's the lower story. But the upper story is about how God preserved his people through the king, through the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And so we don't always know what God is doing when we look at our lower story. But one thing we know, there's an upper story where God knows exactly what he's doing. God knows exactly
what he's doing. God knows what he's doing in your life. And I know some terrible things, some horrific things, some tragic things have happened probably to most of us in this room at one time or another in our lives. Things we never imagined we could have lived through. And we wonder, God, where are you? But I want you to know God is right in the middle of it. And I don't say that lightly. But that's what the Word of God tells us. He's right in the middle of this. We ask, God, where are you in this? God, why don't you answer my prayers? God, what is going on? And the story of Esther says he's there. He's in the middle of it. He is working out his perfect plan and purposes. When you think the deck is stacked against you, let God play out his hand. Finally, we learn in this story that God's sovereignty, so this mysterious sort of control of history that God has, it does not nullify the need for courageous action. That's what's amazing about this story. It declares the sovereignty of God, but at the same time, it doesn't nullify our choices. Our choices matter, right? Esther's choice mattered. As Mordecai said, listen, Esther, you got to understand this. If you don't make the right choice, God will still raise up deliverance for the Jews. But still, Esther, your choice matters. It matters for you. Our choices matter. And our defining moments in our life often bring us to those places where we have to choose. Defining moments involve risk. You may not have to risk your life like Esther did, but you may have to risk your reputation, your friendship, your job, maybe even our financial security. Defining moments reveal our identity. Who am I? Am I a Persian beauty queen or a Jewish exile? And, you know, we all have those questions about ourselves. Whatever you tend to get your identity from, we have to answer that question. Who am I? Am I a Stanford alumni? Which, by the way, I'm not. But am I a Stanford alumni? Or am I a follower of Christ? Am I a U.S. citizen? Or am I a follower of Christ? Am I a scratch golfer? Or am I a follower of Christ? I could even ask the question of myself. Am I a pastor? Or am I a follower of Christ? And I think those defining moments really bring to the fore, who are we? And our choices reveal who we are. And it just reminds me, and I'll close with this, of another courageous choice. And we have a Savior who is much like Esther, an unlikely Savior, who rose up and made a courageous choice on our behalf to save us from sin and death and the devil, to save us from a worse fate than even the Jews would have experienced under that edict by Xerxes. Let's pray. God, we thank you this morning for your word, and thank you for this wonderful story. And my prayer, Father, our prayer is that this story and the beautiful way in which it is told would stick in our minds. And even more importantly, what would stick in our minds is the truth that it reveals, that you are a God who is sovereign. And even though there is real evil in this world, that you are able even to use that evil to accomplish your good purposes. That nothing can thwart your hand and your plan in our lives. And Father, I pray that for those of us here who face choices about who we are, choices that expose us to great risk, that we would be like Esther. And that not without prayer, we would move forward and say, I'm a follower of Jesus Christ. We thank you for your word.